From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! Police taser and pepper spray protesters seeking to halt the demolition of thousands of units of public housing in New Orleans. Hundreds of people are turned away from the New Orleans City Council meeting, which unanimously voted to continue the demolition. We'll speak with a community activist, a housing resident, and a former SWAT commander. Then, forgotten crises, the top 10 most underreported humanitarian stories of 2007, and mutiny in Iraq. All that and more coming up. To Democracy Now. Holiday weekend. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan, maybe you can take over the headlines.
Yes. Well, the New Orleans City Council has unanimously voted to continue the demolition of 4,500 units of public housing. Under the plan, the city's four largest public housing developments will be taken down and replaced with mixed-income homes. On Thursday, hundreds of people were turned away from the city council meeting. Some of the protesters were shot with pepper spray and tasers. Inside the city council chambers, the scene turned chaotic when police arrested 15 people. New Orleans police also tasered protesters inside the New Orleans City Council chambers. More on this story after the headlines. The House Intelligence Committee has subpoenaed the former head of the CIA's National Clandestine Service to testify about his role in the destruction of tapes documenting the interrogation of two prisoners. Jose Rodriguez has been named as the official who directed that the tapes be destroyed. Rodriguez has been called to appear in January at what would be the first public hearing into the CIA tape scandal. At the White House on Thursday, President Bush declined to tell reporters whether he agreed with the tapes' destruction. He also said he did not learn about the matter until the New York Times broke the story last week. The New York Times reported this week four top White House lawyers took part in talks on destroying the tapes beginning in 2003. In Pakistan, at least 50 people have been killed in a suicide attack targeting a former senior government minister. Dozens more were wounded. In Israel, the occupied territories, at least four, in Israel and the occupied territories, at least four Palestinians were killed Thursday in an Israeli attack on the Gaza Strip. Several others were wounded, including a 7-year-old boy and a journalist working with Reuters television. The journalist's colleague, Abed Shana, said Israeli troops shot without provocation.
I entered because they said the martyrs and the ambulance was going to get them, so we entered with the rest of the journalists. They shot at us. Nahid got wounded, and heavy gunfire continued. We were wearing our flak jackets, and there were children in the area and some young men. There was nothing going on in the direction which I was heading. There were children, and there was nothing going on.
Palestinian militants, meanwhile, shot three rockets at a nearby Israeli town. One rocket landed close to a school, but no one was hurt. Meanwhile, Israeli officials have issued a new response to a truce offer from Hamas. A government official says Israel would consider a deal only if Hamas agrees to stop smuggling arms and open talks for the release of the captured soldier Gilad Shalit. Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh said this week he would prevent rocket fire if Israel stopped the killing of Palestinians and lifted its blockade of the Gaza Strip. President Bush is planning on visiting the region next month for the first time during his presidency. On Thursday, Bush said he was looking forward to a great trip.
I'm looking forward to going to the Middle East. Got a couple of objectives. One is to advance the Palestinian-Israeli peace process. Secondly is to continue to work with our Arab friends on reconciliation with Israel. And finally, is to assure people in the Middle East that we understand or will show a strong commitment to the security of the region and a commitment to the security of our friends. And it's going to be a great trip.
The Bush administration is pushing its own version of a peace deal after rejecting an Arab League offer for peace with Israel in return for a complete Israeli withdrawal from the occupied territories. In Britain, three newly freed Guantanamo Bay prisoners have been reunited with their families, although two faced the threat of deportation. Abdunur Samur was released Thursday without charge. The other two, Jamil Ilbana and Omar Deghayez, were arrested on charges of belonging to an al-Qaeda cell in Spain. The actor Vanessa Redgrave paid $80,000 towards their bail. Their attorney, Clive Stafford Smith, says the deportation attempts are baseless.
When the Spanish wake up and smell the coffee, they'll realize what's going to happen to them. I mean, what they're trying to do is just terrible. And I'd be very surprised if Jamil Ilbana ever goes to Spain, because we've investigated all of this. The Americans have investigated it. They've cleared Jamil. And for them to put him through more of this torture after 5 years in U.S. custody is just reprehensible.
Spain has come under criticism for requesting the extradition only after the prisoner's release. Jamil Ilbana left the court to see his children for the first time in 5 years. He had never met his youngest daughter, who was born during his imprisonment.
Thank you very much, everybody. Everybody.
Excuse me.
My solicitor, British people, and the British government, everybody, MPs for Parliament, everybody, thank you very much for your help. I am tired. I want to go to home. I see my children. Thank you very much.
Meanwhile, the family of Omar Deghayez waited anxiously before he was allowed to leave the courtroom.
I'm so stressed, and last night I didn't sleep until morning. I can't sleep.
Do you have faith in the British justice system for your son?
I hope. I have hope with the English system. But I don't know in the end what the play will be. You know, that's it.
Yeah, it feels very unfair because we only found out last night at midnight that it's all been changed.
In Iraq, the top official overseeing construction of the U.S. embassy has resigned. Retired Army General Charles Williams is the third senior State Department official to step down amidst ongoing diplomatic and contracting woes in Iraq. The State Department's Inspector General and head of diplomatic security also have resigned. Williams had promised Congress the massive U.S. embassy would open last September, but construction is ongoing amidst the allegations of shoddy work and unlawful contracting. At the White House, President Bush has signed into law a measure waiving taxes on some homeowners facing foreclosure.
The bill I signed today will help this effort by ensuring that refinancing a mortgage does not result in a higher tax bill. Under current law, if the value of your house declines and your bank or lender forgives a portion of your mortgage, the tax code treats the amount forgiven as money that can be taxed. And, of course, this makes a difficult situation even worse. When you're worried about making your payments, higher taxes are the last thing you need to worry about.
The president's housing plan has come under criticism because it covers only a small number of subprime borrowers, just 7%, according to the Center for Responsible Lending. A subprime loan offers borrowers a mortgage, but at a disproportionately high rate they often can't afford. The subprime market has fueled a record 1 million foreclosures this year, with an estimated 2 million expected in 2008. California has the second highest rate of foreclosures in the country. In Ontario, California, a tent city housing the homeless, has grown to 200 residents since opening in July. Homeless activist Jane Mercer said she expects the camp to grow amidst the subprime crunch.
We are seeing a lot of families who are hitting the streets. We had a family just come in this morning, three children, 8, 10, 12 years old, and they've just lost their home.
Nationally, foreclosure filings are up nearly 1% over 1 year ago. A district judge has ruled the Bush administration did not violate the Constitution when it denied the visa of one of the most prominent Muslim intellectuals in Europe. Tariq Ramadan was offered a position at the University of Notre Dame in Ohio in 2004. The Bush administration barred his entry without explanation. Following a court order, the White House later claimed it barred Ramadan because he once gave money to a French-based Palestinian charity. The charity is legal in France. On Thursday, U.S. District Judge Paul Crotty ruled the administration has shown legitimate reasons for barring Ramadan. The American Civil Liberties Union says it will appeal. Jamil Jafar of the ACLU's National Security Project said, quote, Professor Ramadan is being excluded not because of his actions, but because of his ideas. The result is that foreign scholars will continue to be barred from the country simply because they have said things that the Bush administration disagrees with, he said. In campaign news, Congressmember Tom Tancredo has dropped out of the Republican presidential race. Tancredo has based his platform on harsh measures to restrict undocumented immigrants. On Thursday, Tancredo said he had succeeded in injecting the immigration issue into the campaign and endorsed former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney for the Republican bid. And Perry Kucinich, the youngest brother of Democratic presidential hopeful Dennis Kucinich, has died. In a statement, Kucinich said his brother was a talented artist who had struggled with mental illness. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Juan Gonzalez here with Amy Goodman, who's now recovered.
I think I have recovered my voice, truly the voice of the voiceless. I got it back. Well, this is Democracy Now!, and we are going first to New Orleans. The New Orleans City Council has unanimously voted to move ahead with the demolition of 4,500 units of public housing. Under the plan, the city's four largest public housing developments will be razed and replaced with mixed-income housing. On Thursday, hundreds of people were turned away from the city council meeting. Some of the protesters were shot with pepper spray and tasered. Inside the city council chambers, the scene turned chaotic when police began making arrests.
Let the people in! Let the people in! Let the people in!
Let those people in! Let them in! Let them in! This is not Germany! Let those people in!
Let the people in!
Let those people in! Their seats right there! Their seats right there!
New Orleans police also tasered protesters inside the New Orleans City Council chambers. Police cited fire marshal regulations to bar many protesters from attending the meeting, but many housing advocates say there are empty seats inside the council chambers. Some protesters began banging on the gates to City Hall to try to get in. They were met with pepper spray and tasers. Eyewitnesses said one woman tasered in the back collapsed in a seizure on the ground.
Police said at least 15 people were arrested on Thursday. New Orleans Police Superintendent Warren Riley said the force was needed after protesters tried to tear down the gate to City Hall. During the hearing, members of the City Council defended their decision to approve the demolition of public housing. Council member Shelley Madura described some of the protesters as, quote, demagogues and terrorists. Madura said, quote, the choice is to either support redevelopment by approving demolition or to reject redevelopment by denying these permits. I am choosing to support what I believe is the reasonable middle ground, a plan to replace and reform public housing.
We're joined by three guests right now in New Orleans. Kali Okuno is the executive director of People's Hurricane Relief. We are also joined by CES45, a community activist. And we're joined on the telephone as well by Howard Robertson. He is a retired major with the New Orleans Police. We turn first to Kali of Hurricane Relief. Describe what happened yesterday and why you were outside and inside the New Orleans City Council.
Yeah, well, Amy, I was outside because I was barred entry to the inside. They made an arbitrary decision yesterday to cut off the inside when there were clearly seats that were still available. I was getting minute-by-minute reports as the events were starting, as the proceedings were starting, that there were still seats available, and they just made an arbitrary decision to keep those of us, there was probably about 100 of us still outside at that particular point in time, to close the gates and to keep us outside. And from there, events just really escalated as they particularly the folks who were on the inside, from what I can see, and CES can give you a more detailed account, as the folks on the inside started advocating for us to be able to actually enter into the building. So, you know, they made a situation of trying to control it and basically stifle and cut off any vocal dissent or opposition to their decision. We knew when we walked in, based on their comments the past several days and based on how they had been treating this issue the past 2 years, that we were going to lose the vote on the basis primarily of Clarkson's new addition to the city council, and that at the very least it was going to be a 4-3 vote along racial lines. So we knew what we were walking into, and we just clearly wanted to make sure that our point was heard, that we disagreed with the plan towards demolition, and that we were going to stand fast and fight this through the courts and through other means as we move forward. So they made a decision to basically shut everything down and shut everybody else down.
And Seth, what was happening inside? Obviously, it was a 7-0 vote, but could you talk a little bit about what was happening inside?
Well, I definitely start with just the process of entering the city council chambers. They changed the whole process for this particular vote. And, you know, upon entering the building, you know, they just made it hard for all the Africans who was coming in the gate, who was clearly identified as, you know, not supportive of demolition. And so they took other measures of, you know, just searching people and putting you through metal detectors and just winding different people. And so we just had problems just entering the building. You know, they closed the building. They locked the gates at 10:30.
CES45, were you tasered
10 o'clock.
Inside?
Yes, I was tasered. But just get inside the building before the proceedings started. You know, we just noticed they had a lot of seats available and a number of Africans in there. It just were very few, and they just closed it off right after we entered the building. So we was asking before they started the proceedings to let more people in because they had a number of seats that was identified inside of the council chambers, and clearly that more. If you can see from the video, you know, they had rum all inside, all on the walls. And so when Reverend Sanders, you know, made a plea after Ernie Felco tried to start the proceedings, he made a plea to let the people in. And that's when everything really started, by Ernie Felco trying to start the meeting without properly letting all the people supporting, opposing inside of the chambers.
Howard Robertson, you're a retired major with the New Orleans Police Department. From what you've heard and seen of what happened yesterday, is this an unprecedented in a city council meeting in New Orleans?
No, it's not. Of course, things certainly got out of hand yesterday, but this is not the first time they've had trouble over this issue in the city council chambers. And usually when things get starting to get riled and are unorderly and they can't hold a meeting in a normal way, if you're familiar with the city council meeting, people take a number, they sign a page that they want to speak in protest, and they're allowed to get up, and there's a time limit for each person to speak. But if people are disruptive and don't allow the normal process to go, they ask those people to leave. Everyone's allowed to speak that wants to. In this particular meeting, they set a cutoff that they were going to cut off at so many people into the building. Now, I can't tell you what that number was. And when they did, no one else was allowed. Now, that had nothing to do with racial lines. If you look at the video, the girl you were talking about that passed out and needed medical attention was a Caucasian female. There were a lot of people there protesting, which they certainly have a right to do. I mean, I can't speak for the council, but I think the council did listen to what they have to say. They studied the process, and when it came time to make a vote, I don't think anyone voted along racial lines because I don't think it's a racial issue. They voted 7-0. It was everybody thought it was the best thing to do for the city, for the people, and to get the city of New Orleans back on track.
Callie Acuno, it was 7-0. It was a unanimous vote. Can you talk about why you were there, why you want to stop the demolition of these 4,500 housing units, the four housing projects of New Orleans?
If I can, I'd like to correct one point that Mr. Howard just made. The woman who was tasered and who went into a seizure never made it inside. She was outside. And she was tasered in the back, unaware. And she was one of the hundreds of people who were trying to get inside at that particular point and was omitted from coming. It had nothing to do with seats being available or anything of that nature. They made that decision to cut that off. Now, in terms of myself being there, my interest is basically trying to, you know, for lack of a better term, Amy, stop this neoliberal destruction that we see taking place in New Orleans. The complete privatization of all of the different services within the city, housing being, I think, the most critical of them, public housing being kind of the cornerstone of that. But there's an affordable housing crisis in New Orleans, of which the public housing is just one particular element of it. It's the most critical element because public housing will stabilize rents in New Orleans. And folks should know that rents have gone up three times since the storm, and it's basically pricing, working people and African people on the whole out of the city. But this is just one particular piece of this whole program. Public hospitals are also being shut down and set to be demolished and destroyed in New Orleans. And they've systematically dismantled the public education system and beginning demolition on many of the schools in New Orleans. That's on the agenda right now. And trying to totally turn that system over to a charter and a voucher system to privatize and just kind of really go forward with a major experiment, which was initially laid out by the Heritage Foundation and other neoconservative think tanks shortly after the storm. So this is just really the fulfillment of this program. And I think, you know, I always want to call people's attention back to the statements that Baker made shortly after the storm, that we finally cleaned out public housing. You know, we couldn't do it, but God did.
He was a Louisiana state legislator who said that. Yeah. Let me ask Howard Robertson, why do you think this is a good thing, the destruction of the 4,500 units of public housing?
Okay, let me explain this, because I think this is really important. Prior to the storm, I think everyone in HUD was attempting to close down the public housing and build new housing prior to the storm. It had nothing to do with the storm. And I think everyone will agree that we had a St. Thomas housing project that was probably a murder there at least once a week. There was somebody shot there almost every day. Drug dealing was rampant. The half of the buildings were boarded up. A lot of it has nothing to do with the residents that live there. You know, it's the drug dealers come in, use the projects for a breeding area. Now, when they tore down the St. Thomas housing project, they built, and I say they, I mean the government, built new townhouses that blend in very well with the neighborhood. The same residents moved back in. It was much, you know, nicer housing. It's all clean. It's all fresh. It's all new. Where the old public housing was boarded up, graffiti everywhere. It was. I just think it's a higher quality of living for everyone. And they've done this with two of the projects already, and have made tremendous success. I know it's going to take years to get this done, and everyone is worried about stabilizing rents because rents have skyrocketed since the storm. It's hard for anybody to find a place to rent now without paying at least double what they did prior to the storm.
But I'd like to ask Kylie Acuno, but isn't the number of low-income units that will result from this far lower than what existed currently with these public housing units?
Yes, it's far lower. And to go back to the St. Thomas example, it was falsely stated that the same residents moved back in. Some of the residents moved back in, but the vast majority of them were displaced and put on Section 8 and scattered throughout the city. That's the same process by which they're proposing now. With all the developments, but particularly with the defeat in the St. Bernard, this whole notion of a mixed income, neighborhood, which is basically just going to scatter working class people all throughout the city on primarily probably Section 8 vouchers, even if those are allowed to continue in a number of different ways. And people are having a hard time in New Orleans right now who are on those finding places to rent because they're basically being discriminated. Folks don't want people who've been stigmatized as being from public housing. And the same thing which is going on with the vouchers right now. So people have vouchers, but because of that, they're not finding places to be able to use them or to exercise them. They're not finding, rental units. So this whole mixed income notion, it's really more of a notion which is protecting other interests other than African working class interests in the city. So it may work fine. For some folks to deal with certain aspects that they find undesirable in the community.
It is interesting.
But it's not going to really work for the residents who are being displaced and then, really have very few options as to where they can go, particularly right now with the housing shortage and the housing crisis in New Orleans.
It's interesting that for the first time in the last election, the New Orleans City Council was voted, is now majority white city council. But I wanted to end with CES 45. You grew up in public housing in New Orleans. What are your plans now? It was a unanimous vote. They say that the public housing units as they stand now will be destroyed in New Orleans. What are you planning to do as a community activist?
Myself, I'm going to continue to fight. We don't honor or validate that decision made by the city council. We think it was illegal. And we're going to go to, court and file a lawsuit against those guys and just keep continuing to fight. And they had a number of people asking for, a 60-day moratorium. Nancy Pelosi, a lot of people sent, letters to the president. Obama and Edwards even stood out, on this issue. And just the whole proceedings was illegal by locking, the people out of locking people out from having access to even enter the building and speak their piece. So a lot of those things that transpired today, yesterday, were illegal. And so we don't honor that vote or that decision. We don't validate that in any shape or form. And so we just going to continue on and using our resistance measures and galvanizing the people and mobilizing the people. And just like we got a lot of national attention on it, we're going to keep pressing this issue. And it's not over. That's my biggest pledge is to let the people know it's not over.
CES 45, I want to thank you for being with us. Community activist Kylie Acuno, the head of the People's Hurricane Fund. Also, Howard Robertson, former SWAT commander in New Orleans. Also, special thank you to Jackie Suen, Mavis York's Broderick Webb, and Luisa Danta and Michael Bodenheimer of Jolu Productions for providing us with video footage from New Orleans. Jackie Suen of Big Noise Films. And to WLAE, the public broadcasting in New Orleans, for hosting our guests today. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute.
This is for the streets. The streets everywhere. The streets affected by the storm called America. I'm doing this for y'all and for me, for the creator. Get ready. Beyonce. These sheets, $1 per a human being. Feel like Katrina clap. See that Katrina clap. Listen, homie, it's Dollar Day in New Orleans. It's water, water, everywhere. People dead in the street, it eats. And Mr. President, he bout that cash. He got a policy for handling the trash. And if you poor, you black. I laugh, they won't give you. You better off. Dead or in jail with a gun in Iraq. And it's as simple as that. No opinion, my man, it's mathematical fact. Listen, a million poor since 2004. And they got aliens and killions to waste on a war. And make you question what the taxes is for. Or the cost to reinforce the broke levy war. Tell the boss he shouldn't be the boss anymore. Yabe on me, God save these streets. $1 per a human being. Feel like Katrina clap. See that Katrina clap. God save these streets. Quit being cheap. Your freedom ain't free. Feel like Katrina clap. See that Katrina clap. Lord have mercy. Lord God, God save our soul. God save our soul. God, God save our soul. Lord God, God save our soul. God save our soul. Soul, soul, soul survivor. It's Dollar Day in New Orleans. It's water, water, hey. When babies dead in the street, it eats. It's enough to make you holler out like where the Sir Bono and his famous friends now.
Most deaf, Katrina Clapp here on Democracy Now! And for those of you who are listening on the radio, you can go to our website to see the video of what was happening inside and outside the New Orleans City Council. Democracy Now! Is broadcasting on over 650 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM, college and community radio stations, as well as on public access TV stations, PBS TV stations, both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also available in Spanish and transcript and audio form for any radio station to take, as are about 150 stations around the world. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan?
It was almost a year ago to the day when the U.S.-backed Ethiopian invasion of Somalia began. 1 year later, the conflict is widely considered Africa's worst humanitarian crisis. The fighting has caused an unknown number of civilian casualties and the displacement of hundreds of thousands of people from the capital. An estimated 60% of Mogadishu residents have fled their homes. But most people in the United States are not aware of what is happening in Somalia. The conflict rarely gets any airtime on any of the corporate networks' nightly newscasts and is given little column space in the major newspapers.
Somalia is one of the top 10 most underreported humanitarian stories of 2007, according to a list compiled by the international medical humanitarian group Doctors Without Borders, also known as Medecins Sans Frontières. The list highlights the plight of people in the Democratic Republic of Congo, Zimbabwe, Sri Lanka, Chechnya, and other places. As we approach the end of the year, we take a look back at these forgotten crises. Nicholas de Torrente is the executive director of Doctors Without Borders USA, joining us in our firehouse studio. Welcome, Nicholas. Good to have you here in the United States and in New York. Go through these crises. Tell us what you're paying attention to.
Well, Amy, as you put it, I mean, the purpose of the list really is to try to, you know, highlight places where we feel that based on our experience as a medical humanitarian organization, and we're not everywhere, but this is the presence of our teams on the ground, where there's really such a mismatch between what we're seeing in terms of the magnitude, the severity of the problems, and then the level of media coverage. So it's a subjective list. It's not a perfect one in terms of the hierarchy of things. But for us, as you put it, Somalia is really very much on the top right now. I mean, our teams are struggling to get in. We have now teams in Mogadishu. We have international staff on the ground, and we're seeing a lot more now about what's going on. And we're having a better access to the population in terms of assistance. And the situation is very, very dire in terms of the violence against civilians. Heavy fighting in highly populated areas with, as we see it, quite a reckless disregard for civilians in Mogadishu, and hundreds of thousands of people have fled, and they're fleeing to the outskirts of the city, but also as far away as we have teams in Galkayo in the north, in Bosaso, which is close to the Red Sea, and all the way into Yemen. We had a team just pick up, try to provide assistance to survivors of who were fleeing into Yemen, and there were 50 people had died in this particular ship. 50 people were able to be rescued. So it's really quite dramatic. People are very desperate in terms of trying to flee what is happening in Somalia.
The Ethiopian troops that invaded are supported by the United States?
Well, yes. There's an international kind of community backing of the transitional federal government that came in on the coattails of the Ethiopian military invasion that took out the Islamic Courts Union who was present in Mogadishu at the time in southern Somalia. So there's an international community kind of backing for this transitional government, and that government is heavily supported by the Ethiopian troops there. But there's also resistance. I mean, the fighting is not one-sided. There are insurgent groups are also committing, atrocities in terms of bombings and disregard for civilians as well. It's not a one-sided affair here.
But why the disparity in some of the coverage of these crises? For instance, there are periodic full-page ads in the New York Times, the Washington Post, over the Darfur crisis, which is nearby to what's going on in Somalia, and yet there's so little coverage of the situation there.
Well, I mean, there are reasons in terms of also, the difficulty of coverage for journalists. I mean, it's not easy to get to Mogadishu. It's not easy to get into Somalia. It's very hard for aid organizations. We're really struggling to work there because of the insecurity. That's the same for Zimbabwe, for instance, where the restrictions, that are posed on journalists being able to cover the situation and for aid organizations to work. So I think that's part of the explanation. And then there's something very special that's happened around Darfur in this country, a kind of a coalition that came up and that mobilized a lot of attention, which is very unusual and very much the exception to the rule. I mean, if you look at the Democratic Republic of Congo, I mean, in terms of the death toll, the impact, the long-standing nature of the conflict and what's going on there, that also has remained quite forgotten compared
what's
to what's going
on there. What are the numbers? Why is it happening?
Well, there's, the thing is, the story of the Congo has been that there have been democratic elections. There's a new president that has been elected. And the story was a hopeful one, that the country would now be, move on beyond the civil war. And there have been two very serious episodes of that. That's not what we're seeing happening in the eastern part in particular. Where today we have the Congolese army backed by the UN forces trying to take out a rebel commander who is holding up in the North Kivu province. And this is a place that's very neighboring Rwanda. So there's a lot of 10 years of interaction with what happened in Rwanda in 1994, the genocide there, people fleeing into Congo. And this is kind of the ongoing continuation of that, and it's not resolved. And
the numbers, Dad?
The numbers. I mean, in this year we've had about 300,000-400,000 new displaced, and these are people who have been affected by war for many, many years, and who are again forced to flee because of the fighting and because of the way the soldiers on all sides behave. In the Congo, soldiers are not paid. They pay themselves, so to speak, on the back of the civilian population. This means looting, rape. Sexual violence is very, very high in the Congo. It's just there's an unending cycle there where that is also fueled by the fact that there's a lot of natural resources, especially in that area, and people, the different groups are fighting over that. So there's political and economic reasons for this ongoing conflict there.
What about some of these other underreported crises, Chechnya and some of the others that get even less attention?
Yeah, well, Chechnya, the kind of intense fighting did drop off a few years ago. What we're concerned about is that, the consequences of the conflict still are very much present. I mean, there's still a high level of instability in that whole region, and the people who've returned to Chechnya from neighboring republics are very traumatized, extremely impoverished, and the healthcare system has really been destroyed. So, there needs to be much more of a focus there. Chechnya was always an embarrassing topic for the international community, backing Russia as a strategic partner. And this was always something that everyone preferred to ignore, what was going on in Chechnya. And now that the more, overt fighting has decreased, it's even easier now to just turn a blind eye to what's continuing to occur in Chechnya and the ongoing effects of the war and the deep-seated problems there that have not been resolved yet.
Nicolas de Torrente of Medicine Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, Burma.
Yes, well, Burma did get, I mean, of course, you've covered it and others have covered what happened, the pro-democracy protests against the military regime there. This is really, in a way, the tip of the iceberg in terms of what's happening in Burma, in terms of the conditions of the population throughout the country. There are places, for instance, Rakhine State, which is in the western part of the country, where the Rohingya population there, these are Muslims, not even considered to be citizens of Burma. And so they have no rights, basically. And so the government disregards them completely. There's a lot of abuse. And the needs in terms of basic health care issues, HIV/AIDS, a major problem in Burma, and TB and other health issues are major problems. And so this is not being talked about. What's going on in the East with ongoing insurgencies, ethnically based insurgencies against the regime, again, not being covered. That area is sealed off. The government does not want aid agencies to be present. So, there are a lot of restrictions to the operations of aid organizations. And since there's a willingness to kind of cut off the regime and not to provide assistance that could support it, there's also a lack of engagement on the humanitarian side. And we think that these things can be a bit dissociated and that there is a way to provide assistance quite, more directly to the population in Burma and not necessarily strengthen the hand of the military regime that doesn't care about the population anyway.
And in Sri Lanka, which has to be one of the longest-running, least-reported battles or ongoing battles in the world.
Well, in Sri Lanka, the problem is that the war flared up again, and there was a big attention to the tsunami, and there was a big aid response to the tsunami, and then attention waned, and the war restarted. It's interesting, actually, that there may be a connection, in fact, because the way the assistance was provided during the tsunami was a cause of grievance between the Tigers, the rebel movement in the north, and the government. I mean, control over the aid flows and so on, which were so massive, was one of the issues that reignited the fighting for the past 2 years. And this leading to a lot of displacement in the east and a lot of kind of the enclave in the north where government services have been really curtailed. And we see it in terms of medical personnel. The hospitals have lost their medical staff, have lost their surgical staff. So we're able to go back in and provide services. But in a climate as well where there's a lot of suspicion of aid organizations, and that's also one of the consequences of the tsunami response, is that seeing this huge amount of aid, somewhat uncoordinated, somewhat unfocused, has raised a lot of suspicions on the part of the government in terms of what aid organizations are there to do, and that has made it more harder for us to provide assistance there. So it's a kind of an ironic twist when there was such mobilization to help Sri Lanka in the wake of the tsunami.
You're talking about some of the worst crises in the world. And according to Andrew Tyndall, publisher of the online media tracking journal, the Tyndall Report, the countries and contexts that you highlight at Medicine Sans Frontières account for just 18 minutes of coverage from January to November 2007 on the three major nightly newscasts.
Right. And it's one of the measures. I mean, people do get their news from a variety of different sources, and there are other ways of getting information. And there's more hunger for that, and we see that in the proliferation of new media outlets, channels, people getting their information over the internet. I mean, you're of course extremely aware of this, but still, the nightly news is a good measure of how the mainstream media tries. The attention it focuses on these issues, and it's a bit shocking, of course, to see that Major, major problems just don't get any attention at all. They don't even deserve. And that's the problem. I mean, we don't think that media coverage is the panacea, that if you get media coverage, you will automatically get a solution. Of course not. But if it's not even reported, it's not even on the radar screen, it's not even on the map, then that's a real issue.
We're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank you very much. We'll certainly link to your report, Doctors Without Borders, at our website, democracynow.org. And if you want to see some of the video images of the countries that Nicholas has mentioned, you can go to our website as well. Nicholas Torrente is Executive Director of Doctors Without Borders USA. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, mutiny in Iraq. Stay with us. Thank you.
Christmas time in Washington, Democrats rehearsed getting into gear for four more years. The thing's not getting worse. Republicans drink whiskey neat. Thank it lucky stars. They said, cannot seek another term. There were no more FDRs. And I said, home in Tennessee. I'm staring at the screen. An uneasy feeling in my chest. Wondering what it means. So come back, Woody Guthrie. Come back to us now. And tear your eyes from paradise. Rise again somehow. If you run into Jesus, maybe he can help you out. Come back, Woody Guthrie, to us now.
Grammy-nominated Steve Earle, Christmas Time in Washington. He was playing in our studios here at Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
In what has been described as one of the most remarkable stories of the entire Iraq War, a reporter from the Army Times has given perhaps the first inside account of how an Army unit committed mutiny and refused to carry out orders in Iraq. The incident occurred in Adamiya, a district in northeastern Baghdad, where soldiers in the 2nd Platoon Charlie Company were stationed. The 2nd Platoon had lost many men since deploying to Iraq 11 months before, after an IED attack killed five more members of Charlie 126. Members of the 2nd Platoon gathered for a meeting and determined they could no longer function professionally. Several platoon members were afraid their anger could set loose a massacre. They decided to stage a revolt against their commanders that they viewed as a life-or-death act of defiance.
The story appears in a major four-part series called Blood Brothers, published in the Army Times by the paper's medical reporter, Kelly Kennedy. She was embedded with Charlie Company in Iraq in the spring and summer of this year. Kelly Kennedy joins us now from Washington, D.C. Welcome, Kelly, to Democracy Now! Just lay out the story for us. How did it begin?
Well, it began. I went to Adamiya. I was working on a story about medics, and I'd heard that Charlie Company had been hit particularly hard, and so I wanted to ride along with their medics and see what they were doing. They were doing some amazing things, tracheotomies on the battlefield and restarting hearts and just really great things. Our second day there, my photographer, Rick Kozak, and I had gone out on patrol with them in the morning, and then they went on a second patrol that we didn't go on, and that was the day that the Bradley was hit, and they lost five men. So we watched them react to that. I guess what amazed me about that day was how strong these guys were for each other, but also how they were willing to look out for us as reporters that they just met. And they flew us out of there that night, and then about a month later, I got a couple of emails from the guys saying, we just lost four more men, and they want us to go out on patrol, and we're not going to do it. And then I couldn't get back to them when I was in Iraq, but when they returned home to Germany, I went to see them. And essentially, they're the hardest hit unit in Iraq so far. I hope that the story would show people exactly what soldiers in Iraq are dealing with. I'm not sure Americans understand exactly what this war looks like to our soldiers. And we just went through the whole 15-month deployment in a four-part series, just showing exactly what had happened to them, from the youngest man in their unit throwing himself on a grenade to save four other men, to battles that they went through. They were catching insurgents, and they were battling every day, but then they were exhausted, too, mentally and physically.
And in terms of the casualties, you have some startling numbers in terms of the percentage of the men who were killed. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, the company itself, there were 110 men who went out on patrol. There were probably 138 men in Charlie Company itself, and they lost 14 men in 12 months. And the battalion, which is about 1,000 people, lost 31 people altogether. So it's pretty extreme.
You talk about, right when you got there, the five men being killed by an IED. Tell us about Master Sergeant Jeffrey McKinney.
Okay, that was about a month later. First Sergeant McKinney was well-loved by his men. He was Bravo Company. He was considered intelligent. When they had a question, he was the one they went to because he could explain things. Everyone thought he was a great family man. One of the soldiers, Ian Newland, told me that he used to ride to work with him every day, and he just loved him. And one day he went on a patrol with his guys, and they'd just been called back into Apache, which was the name of the combat outpost where they were in Adamia. And he apparently said that he'd had it. He looked at a wall, he fired a round, and then he took his M4 and he put it under his chin and he killed himself in front of his men. It left a lot of people just saddened and horrified. And then the next week, Bravo Company was hit by an IED and they lost four guys too.
The military first ruled it an accident, then admitted that it was a suicide.
I'm not sure they did an investigation. I don't think they admit anything until they're done with an investigation in the military. But yeah, I think that they were worried about morale at first, and so when they called the guys back in, it wasn't, they didn't announce that their first sergeant had just killed himself. They said there's been an accident. So
your series presents a really fascinating picture of how the medical folks who dealt with some of these soldiers, the psychologists who dealt with them, reacted to their situation, and also how the commander dealt with being faced with an actual mutiny by his troops. Could you enlighten us about that some more?
Yeah, I think that's one of the key differences of this war. I'm a veteran myself, and I served in Mogadishu, and I served in Desert Storm. We didn't know what PTSD was, post-traumatic stress disorder. We didn't have mental health people we could go to while we were out in the field or while we were out in battle. We didn't talk about ethics. We didn't talk about how we were feeling or how we would react professionally to certain situations. And these guys they're going to mental health and they're saying, hey, I'm upset about this. And the mental health people are talking with the unit commanders and saying, hey, maybe you need to pull your guys out of Adamia, or hey, maybe your guys need some more rest. And they're certainly saying, listen, if you think you're going to act unprofessionally, you need to do something else. You need to take care of that. And I think that's huge. I don't think a lot of people understand that that's a big difference in this war, between the last war and this war. And the reason they do that is because early on in this war, we did have situations where troops did not behave properly. In Vietnam, we certainly saw it. For these guys to stand up and say, listen, we're not sure we can handle it right now, could be considered very courageous, in my mind. The commander, I think, also realized that, and he said as much, that he sees the two sides of the situation. After Bravo Company's IED went off, Charlie Company was supposed to go back out and patrol the same area. When some of the members who had been patrolling with Charlie Company before, the scout platoon, went as the quick reaction force to the IED attack for Bravo Company, they were struck by how much it looked like the first IED attack, the roadside bomb attack, and they reacted as if it were their own men, and they went right to mental health, and they got sleeping medications, and they basically couldn't sleep and reacted poorly. And then they were supposed to go out on patrol again that day, and they, as a platoon, the whole platoon, it was about 40 people, said, we're not going to do it. We can't. We're not mentally there right now. And for whatever reason, that information didn't make it up to the company commander. All he heard was Second Platoon refuses to go. So he insisted that they come. They still refused. So volunteers went out to talk with them, and then he got the whole situation. In the meantime, it was called a mutiny, which is probably a bigger word than should be used for it, but that's what the battalion called it. And eventually what they did was they separated the platoon. They said, you know, you guys aren't acting well together anymore, so we're going to split you up and we're going to have you work with other platoon sergeants and other squad leaders and see if we can turn things around this way, but they also punished them in a sense by flagging them and saying that they couldn't get promotions and they couldn't get their awards for 2 months. So there was a feeling that there had to be punishment for these soldiers refusing to go out on a mission, but there was also understanding that the guys may have acted properly in this case.
Kelly Kennedy, I think what is so profound about the story is the refusal of the men to go out. Were there women, by the way, in this unit?
No, it's all infantry.
The refusal of these men to go out because they were afraid they would commit a massacre. Explain that.
Yeah. I need to say this, they are good guys. I mean, I saw them take care of each other. I saw them take care of Iraqis. When the IED, the roadside bomb, went off, it was so close to one of the Iraqi police stations that they should have been able to see somebody burying that. It was right in front of somebody's house, and nobody said anything. Nobody said to these guys, listen, there's a bomb here, we're worried about you, even though they'd been going out and patrolling and doing what they were supposed to be doing in their minds. So when that IED went off and killed their five friends, and you have to understand they've been living together for a year like brothers in the basement of this old palace, and they're right on top of each other and going out and taking care of each other on the battlefield daily, firefights. And so they're closer probably than anyone could be. When they lost their five men, I think they gave up on the Iraqi people. If the Iraqi people weren't willing to fight for them, then what was the point? And they were so angry. They just wanted to go out and take out the whole city. They didn't understand why they couldn't finish up what they call the war. And the whole idea of counterinsurgency is that you're supposed to be building relationships, but they're trying to build relationships with people who obviously aren't that concerned about them. So this idea of a massacre was just... They were just so angry they could barely contain it anymore.
And that sense that you capture so well in the article, the soldiers finding that they're on a mission to help a people, but to have so much hostility from the very people that they are there to help, the impact of that on their fighting ability or on their morale.
It was huge. I think they could see it from both perspectives. We went out on patrol one morning. It was 6 o'clock in the morning, and they had to go in and search houses, and they were waking people up, and the Iraqis didn't look happy to see them, and the guys weren't happy to have to wake people up. And so they're sort of wary of each other anyway. They were still doing the things that you see, the handing out the teddy bears and playing with the kids and playing soccer and that sort of thing. But at the same time, they never felt safe. I mean, it was daily that they were catching grenades and live fire, and these IEDs were all over the place. It just they just never felt like they were getting anywhere. When they thought that they'd built a relationship with a Sunni colonel, the colonel was fired because the Baghdad government's Shiite, and they didn't trust him as a colonel in the Iraqi army. So as soon as he was gone, they had to start all over again. It just seemed like every time they made progress, it was slammed back down again. They just weren't getting anywhere.
Kelly Kennedy, I want to thank you for joining us and for doing this series of pieces, the medical reporter for Army Times. She's the author of a 4-part series, Blood Brothers. We'll link to it at our website, democracynow.org. As we wrap up today, on Monday and Tuesday, Democracy Now! Specials. On Monday, an hour with Lawrence Ferlinghetti, the poet, writer, the founder of City Lights Bookstore in San Francisco. And on Tuesday, we spend the hour with Dave Isay, who is the force behind StoryCorps, as this team goes out around the country collecting the stories of people throughout the United States, thousands of them, people interviewing each other here in New York. It's right at Grand Central and down at Ground Zero, and StoryCorps mobiles going around the country. Thousands of them are now being archived at the Library of Congress. We'll hear some of those stories. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Aaron Mate, Angelique Comet, Jeffrey Hagerman, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Ricardo Lobo, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Peter Curries, our engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Hani Massoud, Rebecca Silver, Samantha Chambly. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, our website, democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.